Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome. Voters across the nation go to the polls in just a few weeks, faced with some critical issues concerning the environment. In the first of a series surveying the nation, we'll check in on the state of Missouri. Also, the East African nation of Mozambique has been crippled by a vicious civil war that has cut down people and trees. A group of Americans is helping to rebuild and replant, and feeling very hopeful about it all.
We feel that there are very big problems in this world, and the environmental are serious in many spots, but we also believe that something could be done. You don't have to sit idle. You can do something, especially if you work together with others.
Michael Norling, director of the Institute for International Cooperation and Development. That story and more this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a national production of WAMC and is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. California has its Big Green referendum. In New York State, voters are being asked to vote on a $1.9 billion Environmental Quality Bond Act. Many other states, too, face similar and far-reaching choices. In St. Louis, Beth Zilbert, director of the state's Public Interest Research Group, tells us there are several quite controversial issues Missouri voters will decide on, either directly or indirectly. One is called the Natural Streams Act.
What it would do is it would set up protection for 52 of Missouri's most pristine streams, disallowing development along the banks, not allowing ATVs and other dangerous and toxic vehicles, motorized vehicles, to be used in the streams themselves. It would also talk about a management plan for some of those streams so that we would disallow emissions, keeping them basically safe and preserved, because tourism is real important here in Missouri, particularly on our streams and rivers. If you haven't tried it yet, some of the best canoeing in the Midwest is here in Missouri on our lakes and streams. And so that's a ballot question that the citizens will be deciding on, whether or not to set up the Natural Streams Act, which will preserve these 52 streams here in the state of Missouri.
The proposed Stream Act is stirring up quite a debate, though. According to Zilbert, everyone is for preserving the streams, but there is disagreement, as you might expect, over how and where this protection should take place. For example, owners of recreational vehicle parks and marinas along the recreational rivers are opposed to the act, believing it would restrict their growth and expansion. Zilbert says these boating and recreational vehicle groups are trying to rally support against the act.
Basically saying to farmers, this act would take away the land from your ownership. And it doesn't take away ownership of the land from the current landowners at all. All it does is it restricts what some of the things they can do. So in other words, it says that the current landowners can't emit toxic chemicals or can't use these dangerous and toxic motorized vehicles in the streams, can't develop certain types of developments, can't dam up the streams or the rivers at their property. But the property is still theirs, and it stays theirs.
Missouri's Republican Governor John Ashcroft is now in his second and final term, a gubernatorial race slated for 1992. Both of the state's U.S. Senators, John Danforth and Christopher Bond, are also Republicans. Missouri's most famous representative is House of Representative Majority Leader Richard Gephardt. Zilbert says some of the congressional races feature interesting, if not controversial, people and subjects. For example, incumbent Representative Mel Hancock from Springfield is being challenged by Patrick Deaton, a lawyer from Springfield.
Springfield, Missouri, which is in the southwest corner, is a very interesting place. It's a very strange mixture of people live down there, because sort of the 60s environmental back to the land movement chose that area to sort of hole up in the early to mid 70s, because it's good farmland, it's beautiful, pretty unspoiled. Yet at the same time, it's also the home for the Praise the Lord, the PTL Club. It's their national headquarters. So you've got some pretty divergent interests down there. So at the same time that you have the PTL's headquarters, you also have one of the state's only city paid for recycling coordinators. You've got a separate composting coordinator, a separate household hazardous waste coordinator, all paid for through city funds. The city set up these programs. Yet again, at the same time, you've got sort of the heart of the Bible Belt, and the governors from there, very sort of conservative politically, very, you know, religiously conservative. Interesting place, and there should be some. I think the race down there for Congress is a fairly close one.
One other hot issue in Missouri features the city of St. Louis and a radioactive waste dump out near the airport.
And they discovered that some of the old Manhattan Project radioactive waste is stored in about 300 barrels of sort of just lying there in containers. And they discovered this a couple of years ago, and as to what to do with it is a very contentious issue, because do you store it on site? Well, the problem is that it's just north of the airport in line with the runway, so it's a fairly dangerous site in case of, you know, God forbid, any accidents. It sits right along the New Madrid fault line, which has become pretty famous lately, in that they're predicting a major earthquake along the fault line. It's north of a major population center. It's just not a good place to store radioactive waste. Particularly also the DOE, the Department of Energy, is talking about storing radioactive waste from areas all around here there as well. If you're going to store your waste there, you might as well store the waste from other places too.
The issue is featuring prominently in the race for the 2nd Congressional District there. Missouri is also facing a solid waste problem, as are most states, though Zilbert says the state has airspace, or additional room, of about 7 to 8 years. Additionally, according to Zilbert, Missouri's political leaders are eager to use the federal Clean Air Bill as a blueprint for statewide programs on auto emissions and air toxics. Beth Zilbert is director of Missouri's Public Interest Research Group. She spoke to us from St. Louis. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. For some, energy-saving measures can mean recycling grocery bags and turning off kitchen and bathroom faucets as soon as possible. For others, it's a full-time occupation and a teaching lifestyle. In Los Angeles, Joy Newell went calling on Julia Russell in her Echo Home and filed this report.
Echo Home sits on a quiet street. Tall bushes encircle the property, which you enter over a small wooden bridge. There's no water under that bridge. It simply marks the entry path over what resident Julia Russell calls California Gold, a blend of wheat grasses that turn dormant and wheat color several months a year. The yard is filled with plants that need little water, and drip irrigation hoses handle the job at a gallon or so an hour instead of a gallon every 2 or 3 minutes.
Most of the trees and the flowers and all of our lawns are supported by water that comes from other places.
Inside the house, Julia Russell was talking to a group of teenagers from the Windward School in West Los Angeles.
We don't have to destroy the environment to get what we want in our lives. And that's what I think is the great challenge of the next century, of this 1990s and the next century, is bringing together the ecological wisdom and our science and technology to create systems that are in alignment with the Earth, not in violation of it. And I think it's very exciting. I think we're going to be able to do it. I think we're an extremely creative species. That's one thing you have to hand us. We've got great imaginations. And if we give ourselves the right challenges, we can accomplish just about anything.
Russell asked those seated throughout the room what their principal concerns about the environment are. Several answered that air pollution worries them more than anything. Others tell her they're upset about all the pesticides used in food production. Another says her principal worry is abuse of animals under cover of food production. And Russell tells her that if Americans were to stop eating meat entirely, the grains used for cattle feed could feed the entire world. The kitchen is another demonstration area. There are recycling bins. The canvas shopping bags used at the grocery store hang on a hook. In the sink is a plastic tub for dishwashing water. Because Russell uses a non-toxic cleaner for the dishes, she can use leftover water in the garden. She shows how she saves waste for the compost bins in the yard.
What we need to arrange in our system is that anything that we have to throw away must be something that can rot, that can biodegrade, because when it rots, what that means is it's going back into the ecological system. That's what rotting is. It means biodegrading. It goes back into the ecological system and it serves as food for plants. That's what happens when something decomposes.
She points down the hallway at the bathroom and talks about the low-flow shower and the low-flush toilet, which uses 1.5 gallons of water instead of about 7 in most toilets. And she tells the students about the rebate programs that pay people $100 for the installation of the new technology toilets in the Los Angeles area. Russell is a slender woman with 2 grown children. A couple of years ago, already well into her project of making her home a demonstration place for environmentally concerned folks, Russell gave up her car. She says she drives her 3-wheeler around a 5-mile radius, and when she has to go further, she takes the bus. That includes many trips to City Hall, where she's an activist for causes like legalizing gray water systems.
As soon as we have a legal code for gray water in Los Angeles, I will be putting together the pipes from my kitchen sink, my bathroom sink, my shower and my tub, and my clothes washer. I don't have a dishwasher. And I'll be bringing all of that gray water into a big holding tank. It will be filtered, and then it will be used to irrigate my trees and my vegetable garden. That's what an automated gray water system was, and you can imagine how much water that can save.
The backyard of the house features a manual, collapsible solar clothes dryer. That's a clothesline. She has a solar cooker back there, a vegetable garden, leaves cover the soil for retention of moisture. There are 3 big bins for the composting of organic materials. Solar panels are installed on the roof. The house's electricity and water heating is done by the sun. There's an office and research library in the building that used to be the garage. Russell maintains a library of what she considers excellent books about the environment and catalogs that feature products either not harmful or positive or both. The class members didn't ask questions, but they did listen attentively for a whole 2 hours. Russell knows that people who take her tours often make changes in their lifestyles after visiting Echo Home. As a matter of fact, one of the 2 teachers with the group was a returning visitor, and he told the students he had made lots of changes since his first time. Russell says she herself started slowly as an environmental activist and has found in Echo Home what she can do to help get information to others. For the Environment Show in Los Angeles, I'm Joy Newell.
Joy Newell reports from member station KCRW in Santa Monica. Many of the Earth's developing nations do not have technology to explore and develop coal, oil, natural gas, nuclear power, or alternative energy sources. They are limited to burning wood. Wood that not only is in short supply, but that when cut causes both soil erosion and global warming. And soil erosion, in turn, is linked to poverty and starvation, keeping a people at a subsistence level. And so it goes, in an endless circle, a circle actually spiraling downward, for there are just so many trees. Until now, though. Through the efforts of the Institute for International Cooperation and Development, IICD, trees are being planted and the cycle broken. Michael Norling is the Institute's director.
We are a school started in 1987. We run 9-month programs where people have a chance to prepare themselves to go to a third world country to be part of a project, to give a helping hand to people in need in other countries, and then return to this country for 2 more months to give presentations and tell others what they have been achieving through this experience.
The nonprofit group is based in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and is open to anyone 18 years of age and older. Some participants incorporate the experience as part of their education, or at least develop a master's program based on what they've seen and what they've done. Though Norling says the IICD itself does not grant credits or degrees directly. Catherine Pereira is one of a group just returned from the southeast coast of Mozambique. While there, Catherine was in charge of running the nursery, located about 15 kilometers from Maputo. Two others were in her group, one overseeing the educational aspects, the other concentrating on commercial development. Catherine's work was very basic.
We bought seeds from the Ministry of Agriculture.
And literally then started from seed?
Yeah, we did. We sowed the seeds in a seed bed and then transplanted them after they were a few weeks old into small plastic bags. We were there during the dry season, so our basic work was producing enough seedlings for the next group to plant. It was also a new nursery, so there was a lot of organizing work to do and a lot of time spent really just getting things in shape. We were in the process of moving some trees from the old nursery to the new nursery. We had a woodlot that was a little bit out of control and needed weeding and general maintenance. There was a lot of work spent with the workers, teaching them how to be responsible workers, teaching them how to be good workers and take initiative for themselves and think about what they were doing. We spent a lot of time setting goals for the workers, how much work they could do in a day and what was reasonable, and getting them to finish that a day, and that was a big part of my work.
Catherine comes from Grinnell, Iowa, and studied political science. She says she had little or no trouble teaching the workers how to plant and care for the seedlings, as farmers, Mozambicans, have been planting all of their lives.
Some of the scientific information they don't know, and they're having practical lessons in that once a week. But I found that they generally had a good sense, and I learned a lot from the workers. In fact, it was a very equal exchange of what I learned from them about practical knowledge about growing seedlings, that they learned from me about maybe organizing and general work.
So what would you say was your role, your purpose for being there?
They don't understand the importance, probably, of planting trees. A lot of what we're planting are trees for fuel. There's a serious shortage of fuel trees. 90% of fuel is used is wood. And so there's a large depletion of resources right now.
In fact, what is going on in Mozambique is more serious even than resource depletion, as Catherine succinctly explains.
The countryside is being destabilized by armed bandits who have no political philosophy, and they're backed by South Africa. So a lot of people have fled the countryside and come into the cities. So the cities are overpopulated. They cannot go out in the countryside to get more fuel. There are no jobs in the city. There's no place to live. There's no place to grow food. So the resources are being depleted very quickly.
Because of the war, the nation is in a state of emergency. Programs that might have been in place are not funded or staffed, and there is no incentive to plant trees when your life is in danger. Linda Bostwick had a big job on her hands.
One of the important points is, okay, after you plant the trees, then what? I had to go around to these different woodlots and then see about how the trees were doing, actually, the care of the trees, and to educate the people in the villages on how to take care of trees. And also my work included to find new places to plant trees. Because, as Catherine already explained, of the war, there isn't a lot of area around the city to plant trees in. So, I mean, it was difficult in the beginning, but the war is slightly improving, and you can extend the boundaries out a little bit farther, and a little bit farther we'll be able to plant more trees. But the most important thing is follow-up, I felt, and follow-up in the care of trees, and then follow-up in terms of finding more places to continue in planting trees.
Right now, IICD plants the trees for free, but the seedlings cost money. Funding right now comes principally from an organization known as Development Aid from People to People, APTP. Eventually, though, it is hoped that the project can become self-sufficient. Toward that end, Kasha Rigby from the University of New Mexico said she employed a humorous but nonetheless effective method, one, in fact, suggested by a Mozambican woman in the planting group.
I think she said it as a joke, actually, that we should go knock on the doors of all these wealthy people and ask to take cuttings from their trees. And that's what we ended up doing. And I spoke very little Portuguese when I first got there. I think we all improved. But when I started this, I really didn't speak much at all. And so I would walk up to these nice big houses and knock on the door, and I could say about good morning, I want your cutting. Can I cut your plants in barbaric Portuguese? And I think these people just thought I was absolutely crazy showing up on their doorstep with my big cutters and going and I tried really hard to explain what I was doing it for, but I think a lot of the time they just let me do it because they thought, I don't know, it's strange enough for a little white girl to come walking up to your door anyway and ask if you can start cutting off their trees. It's a whole different story. And the good part, hopefully, the people that were cutting off these trees are actually people we're aiming to sell them back to also. So I don't know if they all fully realize that, but I tried to explain it anyway.
Interestingly, according to the group, the Mozambican farmers knew little or nothing about composting or soil composition. So, in addition to discussions about actual tree planting, the group also provided information and instructions on how and why to start a compost pile and how to maintain optimum soil conditions. Each team from IICD spends 2 months in preparation, 5 months in the field, and then 2 months debriefing, each team overlapping so there is always a group on location. This year, they hope to transplant 200,000 trees. In all, it is a huge task, but one full of hope, says Michael Norling.
We feel that there are very big problems in this world, and the environmental are serious in many spots. But we also believe that something could be done. You don't have to sit idle. You can do something, especially if you work together with others. So when we go to another country, we don't go as one person, but as a group, because we believe in cooperation. Mm-hmm. And we also believe that countries can help each other, that we as North Americans and with our expertise in some fields can share things with people in other countries so that things will really start moving.
Michael Norling, Executive Director of the Institute for International Cooperation and Development, based in Williamstown, Massachusetts. For The Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Environmental policymakers long have recognized that we need rules and regulations to guide us, to goad us, really, that we cannot rely on voluntary compliance or individual inspiration to protect the environment. But where there are laws, laws will be broken.
The fact is that there are occasions, unfortunately, where violations of environmental laws and conduct that's egregious to the environment rises to the level of criminal behavior.
Jeffrey Amestoy, Vermont's Attorney General. He has been named to the National Environmental Enforcement Council.
And one of the efforts of all of us involved in this initiative is to attempt to make it clear to those who make a conscious choice to despoil the environment or otherwise degrade the environment that they can run the risk of criminal prosecutions. I know that's been a focus now really for the first time in recent history of the federal administration. It's certainly been a focus in Vermont, and again, from the stories I hear from other jurisdictions, it's becoming a focus there as well.
Now, let me understand a little bit about are you focusing on individual violations, or would you be targeting corporations and industry, or would this be targeting state agencies and state governments? At what level are you operating here?
We have a profile of an environmental offender. And certainly each of the groups you have mentioned and individuals you have mentioned can and have been involved in environmental crime. The effort is to really take a look at, the patterns of environmental crime that may be occurring and compare notes on that to see whether, for example, what's happening in Vermont in the Northeast is happening elsewhere. Secondly, to try to get both consensus and exchange of ideas on what seems to work in terms of cooperative efforts.
The National Environmental Enforcement Council is a joint project of the U.S. Justice Department, the Environmental Protection Agency, and various state and local government agencies. The council gathers twice a year for meetings that Amestoy describes as candid discussions on a wide range of problem areas.
For example, one of the areas that we're interested in here as a result of some recent experiences in Vermont is that of what we call midnight dumping. As a result of the increasing difficulty of finding certified landfills for waste, both hazardous and non-hazardous. Farmers have been approached by individuals who are arranging to dump literally tons and tons of waste brought up from the Boston area, the Rhode Island area, and dumped in the midnight hours. And that's, again, from comparing notes with those in other jurisdictions, although we're seeing it more in the Northeast because of, again, the premium on landfill sites. It is a problem that's more than is occurring in other jurisdictions as well.
The NAEC gives its members a chance to share experiences. For example, midnight dumping in Vermont is similar to another situation.
In talking with other members of the council, some of whom had jurisdictions close to international borders, particularly in the Southwest, they were running into problems of international dumping, that is, that hazardous waste being trucked out of the California area into Mexico, for example. Part of the comparison of solutions to that kind of problem occurred when, for example, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of New York in the Buffalo area had some similar experiences on the border with Canada. So we talked about, for example, how you can work with Customs and with other officials to try to identify some pattern relating to the practices of illegal dumping.
Jeffrey Amestoy, Attorney General from the state of Vermont, a member of the National Environmental Enforcement Council. In addition to U.S. Attorney General Dick Thornburg and Environmental Protection Agency Chief William Riley, the council is comprised as well of four other state attorneys general besides Amestoy. There is Lacey Thornburg of North Carolina, Bill Webster from Missouri, and Kenneth Eikenberry of Washington State. Also serving on the council are three state regulators, Lewis Shaw of South Carolina, Dale Topman of Florida, and New York State's Environmental Conservation Chief Thomas Jorling. Finally, there are four district attorneys on the council board, Richard Ayoub of Louisiana, Oakland, California's John Meehan, from Golden, Colorado, Donald Milkey, and finally, Lynn Slaby from Akron, Ohio, members of the National Environmental Enforcement Council. For the Environment Show, this is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our show for this week. The Environment Show is a weekly half-hour program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, feel free to drop us a line. It's the Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue. We're in Albany, New York, and the zip code is 12206. Before we go this week, we'd like to welcome a brand new station to the Environment Show Network. Hello to good friends listening to WFSU-FM, Tallahassee, Florida, Florida State University. Glad to have you with us this week, and we hope you'll tune in next week. This has been a WAMC national production. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.